This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to another episode of The Gary Hour. I'm your host, Gary Levitt. This week, I talked to filmmaker and TED Talks giver, Savannah Rogers. We're going to hear about filmmaking, what goes into giving a TED Talk, and we're going to hear her coming out story, growing up in Kansas. This episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of mobile apps for content creation. If you're a filmmaker, a musician, a podcaster, a voiceover artist, whatever content you create, go to the App Store and search for Future Moments because they have an app that'll make your life easier and your production so much better. All right, check out the show notes for links to Savannah's work, which is really great, and I think you should check it out. And enjoy. Awesome. Yeah, you're really good.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah. Savannah Rogers, thanks for being here. You are an excellent filmmaker, I gotta say. Everything that's on your site is really well done.
Oh, thanks, man. Appreciate it.
But before we get to your work, I wanna ask you, you're here in New York from Kansas City, Missouri?
I'm from the Kansas side, but it's all Kansas City.
It's all a rural middle America place.
Well, Kansas City's not that rural. I mean, it's the metropolitan area that everybody kind of flocks to.
But right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, not rural.
I'm from the suburbs.
There's people.
There are people.
Right.
I can confirm there are people there.
Well, a listener and friend of mine said that one of his complaints was that I always have New Yorkers on and they complain about how hard New York is. And he lives in the mountains in Colorado. And he's like, let them experience a winter in Colorado. See how hard it is.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have a non-New Yorker here.
Oh, yeah. It's I've only been here a few months, but I feel embraced by the city and mm-hmm. also equally embraced by everybody back home. So it's nice to kind of straddle that line.
Yeah. You're in that sweet in between where New York hasn't chewed you up yet.
Yeah. So far, New York's been like super awesome to me.
No, New York's great, yeah. But you're here because you got selected for a TED residency?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, what is a TED residency?
This is the question I probably get the most since I like moved here.
Right.
So basically, TED is, you know, TED Talks, ideas worth spreading, that's their whole thing. And so what they offer is a 14-week residency for people of all different disciplines. So like journalists are in the program, photographers, you know, biologists, like all kinds of different disciplines, right? And everybody comes together for 14 weeks. There's 20 of us. And we work on our separate projects. And we also all work on a separate TED Talk. And then we all give our TED Talks at the end of the 14 weeks, which is coming up real soon.
Yeah, when is yours?
I give it December 5th.
And you tape it live once, that's it, and it airs?
Yeah, so it's called a salon. And mm-hmm. so we all give our TED Talks in a salon. And basically they film it.
Like a nail salon?
No, like a fucking what do you call it? Like a presentation, right?
Like a symposium.
Yeah, like a symposium. And so we all, like 10 of us will go each day. And like there's an audience and it's like in this like auditorium that's at the TED headquarters. And it's pretty rad. And so we all give our talks. And then a couple months later, they show up on TED.com.
Nice. So obvious next question. Yeah. What is your TED talk on? Your theory, your thesis.
So it's like, it's weird because like this TED talk is kind of a culmination of like the three questions I get asked most all the time, which is how did you become a filmmaker? How did you come out? And
come out because you're
because I'm queer. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm pansexual, but it's all gay. It's all gay. Everything's gay.
Okay. Pansexual. You'll have to define that for me.
Sure. And then what was the other thing that people always ask
Number
me?
Three.
What's my favorite movie? Because I'm a filmmaker.
Huh.
And so my talk is on basically how the movie Chasing Amy kind of like changed my life for the better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how it's such a rad movie to me and what that did for me as a queer kid in Kansas who like didn't know anything. You know, I wouldn't say that sheltered, but I didn't know about too much queer stuff. I didn't know, you know, what any of these terms really meant. I knew what gay was, but I didn't know what bisexual or pansexual was.
Right.
And so this movie like fundamentally changed my life.
How old were you when you realized that you were not heterosexual?
It's a weird question because it's like, I think the first...
Because that's the default.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean like people just assume you're like straight until otherwise proven gay pretty much. Which exactly. I would say is the opposite. And for me, everybody's queer until they...
I hope that's in your TED talk. That's a good line.
That's in my next TED talk, but how why everybody's queer until otherwise proven straight.
Yeah.
But I had my first crush on a girl when I was like 5. Mm-hmm. And it was weird because I like hated her at the same time too. This has been a pattern. It's been a pattern with all my previous partners until my current one, and which is a whole other. That's another TED talk too.
Well, we'll get to this.
Yeah. But you know, I didn't really know until like I saw other people who were queer. Mm-hmm. But I was pretty like asexual until I was like a teenager. You know, so like I had crushes like on people, but like I also had friend crushes on people. It's kind of hard to decipher when you're kind of a kid that doesn't, you know, I didn't have a lot of social skills. I wasn't very present in terms of understanding social interactions.
Were you not exposed to other queer people?
My mom's best friend was gay. And mm-hmm. so I knew what gay meant.
Okay.
But I also knew like, that's not entirely me.
Was your mom's best friend a woman?
It was a man.
Man. Okay.
Yeah. So he was a gay little man. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean like you know, my mom always told me like, if you were gay, I would love you no matter what. And I was like, cool, mom.
Was she like trying to drop a hint?
Well, apparently, so this is interesting. She said when I was young, I was like, I was like, I'm going to marry a girl. I'll never marry a boy. And I was like, wow, that would have been really fucking helpful to know.
That was your first sentence.
Yeah. Pretty much.
She didn't tell you?
Gay from the womb. No, but it's, you know, it's so, everything's weird, you know, but once I saw Chasing Amy, I was like, oh, sexuality can be fluid.
What,
right?
What can you give us a synopsis of that movie?
Yeah. So Chasing Amy is a romantic comedy from 1997, about a man who falls in love with a self-identified lesbian, and then they become best friends and they fall in love after being best friends. And then their relationship kind of implodes after he realizes that he's not the only man she's ever been with.
Uh-huh.
And so, but it's really, you know, it's from the guy's perspective, but it's really about this like woman and fluid sexuality and, you know, love and loss and relationships. And it's a really beautiful film. And when I saw that, you know, something, I didn't quite understand everything the first time I saw it because I was 12.
Right.
But it did a lot for me. And so.
Because it was your first introduction to an alternative sexuality.
Pretty much. I mean, you know, my mom was always like, we'd love you if you're gay. And I was like, great. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, I didn't entirely identify with that term. And, you know, after a lot of, you know, searching after seeing this movie, because I didn't know there were other gay movies.
Right.
you know, it was that the term pansexual is what most resonated with me, which just means, like, you know, I'm attracted to people regardless of their gender. So, you know, it's really, for me personally, it's about the emotional connection. You
right.
know, different people who are pansexual have different definitions, but it's pretty inclusive of people regardless of where they are on the gender spectrum or sexuality. And it's just, you know, for me, it's about the person.
Is, from a term point of view, is it more encompassing than bisexual?
Some people would argue that. I think that pansexual falls under, like, the... It's all so complicated sometimes, needlessly. But,
right.
There's this thing called the bisexual umbrella where, like, you know, you have, like, a tab here that says bisexual. And then under that, there are a couple of things that are, like, encompassed within that term.
Right.
And so pansexual is just a little more specific, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have this, like, egalitarian view of sexuality sometimes where, you know, in an ideal world, everybody is pansexual, right?
Right.
And that's how I feel.
Yeah.
Is that
I like that
care.
Better than bisexual.
Yeah.
It's, like, all encompassing.
It's all good with me. But, you know, pansexual is what feels best to me. And, you know, I'm attracted to men sometimes in spite of their personalities, you know,
but that's quite an accomplishment.
I would say so.
So you're attracted to the people.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And, I feel like I found my person, you know, I've been with my partner 4 years now,
mm-hmm.
but we met online and before I ever saw her face or her, you know, heard her voice, I was like in love with her.
Just through text.
Yeah. Just through like messaging each other.
Yeah.
I was like, I feel really seen by this person.
Mm-hmm.
And,
app did you meet on?
It was a social networking site called Tumblr.
Oh yeah. Tumblr. Huh?
Yeah.
That's not a dating app.
No, not at all.
Yeah. You just read our blogs.
Yeah. Like we just became friends cause we both liked the TV show Glee,
uh-huh.
which was
right.
another person who changed my life, Ryan Murphy, the creator of Glee, you know, it's so weird how everything connects, but you know, I never knew what she looked like. And then, I just like fell in love with her hard. But she had started dating somebody else pretty immediately after we met. And mm-hmm. so like, I waited a long time. And so we were friends for like a year and a half, 2 years before I said anything.
Yeah.
And then we had just kind of just been dating ever since I told her after she had broken up with that person.
Right. So looks must matter in some way though.
Yeah. Like I'm deeply attracted to her, but you know, I became deeply attracted to her after I fell in love with her.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
but like, you know, people are attractive to me. I'll be like, wow, that person's gorgeous or something. But right. For me, it's just all about that connection
because mm-hmm.
I can't deal with people who I'm not connected to.
So as a pansexual, do you have to come out? Like, did you have to come out to your mom?
Yeah. So that was that's a big talking point in the TED talk.
Yeah. I'm trying to stay on track here. Trying to be professional.
Yeah. So in the TED talk, I discuss, you know, coming out, seeing mm-hmm. this movie and, becoming a filmmaker. And so all three of those kind of questions that I always get are kind of answered once and for all. It's like
right.
in a 6-minute TED talk, I encompass like this huge part of my life, I feel like. And, I feel proud of it.
How was it when you, how old were you and how did it go when you came out to your mom?
I was 19 when I came out, I think, or it was 18. I was 18 when I came out to my mom and 19 when I like just came out, period.
Mm-hmm.
It's
all your friends, other family members.
Yeah. So I came out to my mom at 18 after I graduated high school, like right before college, just mm-hmm. because it was such a pain in the ass to be closeted. But, you know,
why was that a pain in the ass?
Because you feel like you're hiding everything. And I never knew, you know, I didn't know like how coming out would like make me feel.
Right.
I didn't know that it would just like set me free.
Yeah.
I had no idea. You know, I didn't have resources the same way. I always look back at like my past self. And I'm like, wow, what a dumbass. You didn't know this. But like, I didn't have like the resources or tools to know that like, hey, when you come out, you're going to feel a lot better.
Right.
I
mean, people must have suspected.
I mean, yeah, I was like terrible at being closeted. Made very little efforts to hide stuff. You know, like if somebody, you know, ever said like a homophobic slur, I'd be like, hey, don't fucking say that.
Right.
But which isn't like a thing that straight people often do when you're like 13 in Kansas.
Right.
You know, like defending, you know, queer people who allegedly aren't present. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Even if they don't even really know what they're saying.
Exactly. And, you know, I was always like, don't say that because, mm-hmm. You know, I did have the context of my mom's best friend is gay. And I was told that this is a word that is really hurtful to people.
Right. There's real people.
Yeah. And, but then I realized, oh, this is hurtful to me too.
Mm-hmm.
So coming out's always like a weird process, but I did come out to my mom at 18. And then at 19, I was like, I'm really tired of telling people individually. I'm just going to like come out.
On Facebook or whatever.
Yeah, I had
flying
like,
blimp with a flag.
Yeah, I had like a YouTube video that I was like, hey, I'm pansexual and I'm kind of done with this shit. And I didn't think anybody had like watched it.
Yeah.
But then, you know, a couple months ago, like around Pride, this other internet friend I had, we met at like a comic convention. And then for the last couple of years, we had sustained our friendship through the internet. And he told me like, hey, like, I realized I was bisexual after you made that video, by the way. I never told you that, but, like, I came out after you did because you said that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that was an option for me before. And I was like, holy shit.
That must have felt great.
It felt amazing.
Yeah. That probably, it seems like that might inform your filmmaking, too.
100%. So I have a policy of no sad gay movies, at least for narrative stuff.
Uh-huh.
Where, like, you know, I've done sad stuff in the past, but I'm just like, there's like way too much sad queer and trans stories out there right now.
Right.
There are way too many of them. And it's a bummer, you know, like when the only representations you see of yourself in the world are rooted in just like how much it sucks to be you.
Right.
And so I try to make stuff that's happy or fun or comedic where like queer people can be funny and queer people can be interesting and multifaceted without it being rooted in kind of melodrama.
Yeah. Before I wanted to talk about your work, but I want to go back a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Because you must have been dreading coming out to not only your mom.
Yeah.
Where's your dad?
So my stepdad, he is from Australia, but he lives with my mom. Okay. And they're actually coming into town to visit today, which is, you know, which is fun because it's the first time they've been to New York since I moved here.
Nice.
But they're extremely supportive. Mm-hmm. My mom and my stepdad are extremely supportive.
Were you dreading having that conversation with them?
Yeah, but, you know, and they were, like, always progressive. They weren't homophobic. They never...
Right, not hyper-religious or
no,
anything.
Not at all.
Like, so there's no threat of, like, being thrown out?
Not at all. I mean, like, I really have the best family to come out to was, you know, queer. You know, it's a progressive family in the Kansas suburbs.
Right.
You know, it's rare, but yeah. they exist.
Because for some kids, coming out is not a good idea if they lose their home.
100%.
And they end up on the streets.
And so I never berate anybody or judge anybody for not coming out because it's not safe. But for me, I knew that I wouldn't be kicked out.
Right. So first of all is your safety.
Yeah.
And then second is your personal freedom.
Exactly. And when I came out, it just like set me free. But I didn't intend on coming out as quickly as I did. I was like going to tell them eventually. My partner, Riley, is actually the first person I ever purposefully came out to because I wanted her to know that I liked her.
Right. So she was just your friend at the time?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you were 19?
I was 17 when we met.
Okay.
And I told her that I thought I was pansexual and she was like, oh, okay, that's cool. And I was just like,
intense.
Loving me back. And so I told my mom years later, and you know, Riley really helped me get the guts to do it. But what? I didn't come out to her on purpose.
Did Riley
like that
say
day.
Yes? Was Riley into it?
Riley. I mean, clearly Riley's into it. I mean, we're together now. It's been 4 years.
Oh, that's the
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry if I didn't make that clear.
I'm
Riley's
putting
my
the
partner.
Pieces together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Sorry if this is like really scattered storytelling. I promise that my TED Talk is more coherent than whatever we're doing right now. But yeah, it's a.
So she helped
yeah.
you
yeah.
come out.
Yeah, I was really scared. And she had known that she was a lesbian for a long time. And
yeah.
she actually didn't come out until 2 years into our relationship to like her family.
Wow.
Yeah.
So she just introduced you as her friend.
Yeah, everybody in America knew, but she's from Mexico City. And so nobody in Mexico really knew except like her friends.
Right.
Her family didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So now she's out to everybody, which is awesome and liberating for her. But, you know... I never judge people for not coming out fast enough.
Yeah. I mean, if your mom had a gay best friend mm-hmm. and you knew she was tolerant,
yeah.
why were you still hesitant?
Because it's so scary to like admit these things to yourself and to put out into the world like, hey, this is who I am. And you don't know if there's going to be a major paradigm shift with how they see you.
Right. Because you're making yourself vulnerable.
Right. And I was dealing with like some really intense depression and anxiety. And I had been having a really hard time in school. And so I never felt shame as like for being queer. But I felt shame for how everybody else reacted to the idea of me being queer because I had a really hard time in school. And, you know, there were multiple reasons I had a hard time in school.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, because I didn't have social skills, I was a fucking weirdo, you mm-hmm. know. But a big part of it is, you know, there was a lot of homophobic bullying that made my life more difficult and right. made it a lot harder to connect to people the way that I wanted to.
Right.
Because in some sense, like, I figured out that, like, okay, I'm not connecting to people the way I want to. I want to be friends with these people, but they hate this part of me.
What part of you?
The queer part, yeah. you know, like.
What now, can you define what part is that? Because they don't know that you're queer. They just sense that you're not a typical old-fashioned.
But when I dress masculine,
right?
You know, I pretty much have tried to dress this way my whole life, and then I
just look like a regular. You're not wearing a dress right now.
No,
t-shirt jeans.
T-shirt jeans.
We're kind of dressed identically, actually. You have the same blue sweatshirt on that I'm wearing right now.
Pretty much, and like. You know, so I would wear, you know, boys' t-shirts, mm-hmm. Boys' jeans that were kind of baggier, you know, they right. didn't hug my butt very much. I wore boy sneakers, you know, I had long hair that I wore in a ponytail every day. You know, I was an athlete, you know, I didn't want to do my hair or anything like that. I also had no concept of it. So not only was I a weirdo, but I presented pretty masculine at a time where, like, it seemed like every other girl dressed very feminine.
Right.
And this was like when like Abercrombie and Hollister were like really big.
Uh-huh.
You know, like that's when I went to school. And right. so everybody had, or like Aeropostale or like all of these like different like clothing brands. And like everybody was dressed really feminine and I was not. And I had no interest in doing it. But
right. So the identity that your yeah. classmates had was a much wider,
yeah.
more common identity.
Totally.
Where yours is... you don't see it in Abercrombie and Fitch catalog.
No, not at all.
So your classmates treated you badly because of that?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, again, a lot of reasons I think that I did not get along well in school. I was weird. I didn't know how to talk to people.
Right.
But also presented, you know, as a queer person, you know, or gender nonconforming. And I think because of that, that was just another target on my back. Mm-hmm. But I had no social skills. Like, I was really naive. I didn't understand, like, social interactions at all. There were a lot of reasons, again. But I will blame the homophobic people for the stuff that they did. So,
and kids, especially at that age, could be mean.
Yeah, really fucking mean.
Yeah. I mean, if you've ever read Lord of the Flies, that pretty much sums it up.
Oh, yeah. That was the book that we had to read the summer going into ninth grade.
Yeah.
And I was just like, man, all you bitches at school are like this.
Totally. That gets you ready for high school.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a weird thing about human nature that way.
Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of these people like maybe aren't homophobic anymore, or maybe they are, you know, but that was my experience in school and it wasn't great. And, you know, I think as a result, I became a lot meaner
mm-hmm.
because like when you're treated like shit, you start to treat other people like shit.
Right.
And so
the abused often becomes the abuser.
Yeah. So I don't know if I was a dick to anybody in high school. If so, sorry.
Right.
Like, but... I did not have a good time in school. And so that really made it difficult for me to come out to my family because I was like, I know that you guys love me, but also I can't be 100% sure that you're going to love me after this.
Right. So what happened when you came out? Was it the opposite where they actually gave you a lot of support that gave you strength?
Oh, totally. My mom was like, is that what all this like drama has been about? And I'm like, yes, of uh-huh. course that's what it's about.
Right.
You know, and they didn't really know what pansexual meant. And I explained it to them and then it became a running joke in my family that I was half gay. That's a whole thing.
Right.
But it's, you know, they were so supportive. I mean, I couldn't have asked for a better family. I mean, they were just, they're the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to come out in high school.
Or no, you didn't come out. I waited mm-hmm. for sure. The only person I came out to on purpose in high school was my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. Good thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, so we're not just friends?
Exactly. Yeah, no.
You've been putting your tongue in my mouth this whole time and you're not gay?
Well, no. I mean, my current girlfriend, sorry.
Right.
Riley, who was in Mexico City
yeah.
the whole time. So, like, the only person I talked to her every fucking day and, you know, she supported me and I supported her. We had a hard time. We were little queer idiot babies who didn't know anything.
Right.
So... but we had each other.
Young love.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the TED Talk is really going to focus, the main focus is your filmmaking, but then you're breaking it apart into all these three different things.
So
on becoming you.
It's a personal story. So it starts mm-hmm. when I'm 12 and I see the movie and then it ends with me at the current moment, you know, about to make a movie about mm-hmm. Chasing Amy.
Is that what you're working on?
Yeah. So my project that I've been working on at TED is a documentary about Chasing Amy and its cultural impact on queer people.
Mm-hmm.
And so through my 6-minute talk, I talk about my personal element a lot. And then, you know, the idea is that the TED talk will be included in the documentary I'm making.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of fun.
Yeah. Is it a lot of work?
A lot of work. But I've had some really good calls and I've got people who are interested in like helping. You know, I got off the phone with a great comic book writer who contributed some artwork to the movie today, and that was really fulfilling because
is Ted helping you with the movie?
Yeah, so they're connecting me with people I would never know how to get a hold of otherwise.
Yeah,
and
because they call on behalf of Ted.
Yeah, like I'll talk to my program head, Cindy Stivers, who's amazing. She used to be the editor-in-chief and president of Time Out. She's had an incredible career, and she is the director of the TED Fellowship, the TED Residency. There is a fellowship, but she's the director of the TED Residency that I'm a part of, and, you know, she's offering me all this advice. She'll email to vouch for me. You know, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, you've hitched to something that's bigger.
Exactly. So Ted doesn't offer like financial support for the movie, but this movie is happening very much thanks to Ted because mm-hmm. we were kind of stagnant in our pre-production process for a bit because I was like, okay, well, how do I get to New York with no money? You know, how do I get the first part of this shoot done with no money?
You hitchhike and you end up living in a box.
Exactly. And I didn't want to do that. So I got this opportunity and ran with it. And so Ted has been really instrumental in helping me, you know, get this done. And so the week after my TED talk, I start my first round of interviews for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really exciting.
How long is the movie going to be?
We're anticipating a feature, so 90 minutes.
Okay, because that's one thing. Another thing I want to talk to you about is that you have a lot of shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And you also are a programmer for Slam Dance.
Yes.
For the shorts.
Yes.
Now, I see a lot of this more and more filmmakers making shorts.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's a place for that in the future? You don't see much of it on Netflix or television in general. Is there a place for that in the future? And will that become more common?
I hope so. I mean, I think, you know, when you're in film school, they tell you a short film is a great way to learn how to make a feature film, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a great building block for any filmmaker of any experience level because if you can be trusted to tell a 5-minute story, you can be trusted to tell a 10-minute story, and so on and so on. It teaches you how to be succinct in your storytelling approach and how to be disciplined, how to only include what matters, like what really matters to your story.
Right.
And so, you know, I've been doing shorts for the last couple of years just to get my foot in the door places, to go to film festivals, to get into rooms that I normally wouldn't, you know, be able to do, but also to prepare myself for, okay, someday I want to make a feature. And that's a big commitment with a lot of money.
And time.
Yeah. And so if you can make a short film that's really effective, you know, it's proof that you can be trusted with more time and more money and more responsibility.
Yeah.
And so my goal has been to make a couple of outstanding short films. And then I will trust myself with a feature. But,
yeah.
You know, like a narrative feature, you know. And then I wanted the first documentary feature I did to be really special to me. And this, I feel like everybody's first feature is personal in some way, right?
Right.
Like if you watch any director's first feature, you know, it says something about them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so this Chasing Amy documentary very overtly says a lot about me because
right.
I'm in it. I have to be in it.
So you're going to direct it and be in it?
Just a little bit. Like I don't want to be in it as much as like Michael Moore is in his movies.
Right.
But I have to be in it to shape the narrative of this is a personal story to me, but also this is much bigger than me.
Right, because people are going to want to put a face to it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, who cares about Chasing Amy so fucking much that they made a movie about it?
Right, it's not really about Chasing Amy. It's really about you and the larger impact.
Yeah, the impact that this movie has had on queer people and, you know, assessing its legacy.
Right.
And I'm the catalyst to give a shit about it, according to everybody I've talked to.
When
I'm wrong, I'm happy to be wrong.
When you first started doing shorts, mm-hmm. like maybe your first or second one, were you surprised at how much work and labor it takes just to make a 5 or 10 minute short?
Oh, I mean, yeah. I didn't know anything about making movies when I first got started.
I think a lot of people don't realize how much work and time and people go into it.
Yeah. I mean, My first short was so bad, nobody will ever see it.
It's not available online?
100% not. Yeah. But I watch it, you know, when I'm feeling like bad. I'm like, you know, if there's ever a moment of self-doubt, I'll like put that on. And I'll be like, you know what? I've gotten a lot better since this.
Yeah.
And so the first short I put on the circuit, I'm pretty proud of. But, you know, that's my official first short film. But the first one I ever tried to make was so horrendously bad.
What went wrong?
Everything. I mean, I didn't know about lights. I didn't know about like how to cast somebody well. I didn't understand principles of acting. I mean, I didn't know anything. I just wanted to make this movie. I had written a script and it was like a silent film except for one line of dialogue, and it was so fucking bad.
Well, at least you didn't screw up the sound.
Yeah, exactly. But you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised how much I fucked up.
It was so bad you screwed up the sound to a silent film?
A little bit. Well, there's one line of dialogue and it just sounded like echoey, and I was just like, how the fuck does anybody do anything? Like, right. How does this work? And so like after that experience, I was like, this isn't what I wanted. How do I make this better? And, you know, I've nothing if not determined. So I basically like really studied how to make films better. You know, I went to film school, but I also immersed myself in every possible situation I could to like learn how to do stuff. I learned from people who are more experienced than me. I partnered up with people who knew more than me, and that I had the story to offer that maybe they didn't.
Right.
And it's worked out. It's just like a process of doing. Really.
What would you say the three most important things are? Is it lighting, casting, sound?
Well, in terms of like specific production elements,
yeah,
probably. But I would honestly really just say like have a story that needs to be a movie, you know, like
right.
Have a story that like matters like to you. If nothing, like really, I watch a lot of movies. I watch a lot of movies for fun, for programming, for different festivals, for, you know, as an audience member at a festival, or, you know, just, you know, watching stuff online, you know, I'm always trying to learn more. And you can tell when somebody, you know, didn't put their whole heart into it.
Yeah.
And if you have that heart and you have that story and you are really self-aware about what makes a movie good, like if you have that self-awareness of, you know, this wasn't great about my last movie, let me put this into my next one, or, you know,
that, do you think people are like, maybe they intend to put their heart into it and then they get a little scared, or they get a little too intellectual about it, and then they do something in the edit to kind of take away their vulnerability, take their vulnerability out of it?
Sometimes, you know, I'm not here to judge anybody else, you know, but I do think that really matters, is, you know, what's authentic about your movie.
Right.
And for the last, you know, after I graduated college, right, you know, I had a pretty successful student film career. And I was like, okay, I got to get out of like JV though. Like I got to bump myself up to varsity. How am I going to do this? And I really took a long time to just like be introspective of what do I want to do? What do I care about? And I think if people were that honest with themselves and maybe had a hard time reckoning that, you know, those things with themselves, that maybe they'd be able to tell stories that maybe feel more authentic to them, you know, something that only that they can provide. And, you know, that's the thing about directing. I feel like I can't do what, you know, somebody else can do, and they can't do what I do. And if every director you came across had that,
right,
I think movies would be better.
Mm-hmm. There's a certain director for a certain job.
Yeah, like, you know, what Martin Scorsese brings to something is much different than what Greta Gerwig brings to something.
Right.
And understanding the fundamental differences that those people bring, you know, it's helpful to understand, okay, what do I bring to the table?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if any of this makes sense.
Well, it makes sense because it's that way in almost every art form.
Like, exactly.
For a band, there's many great drummers. Mm-hmm. You could have a great drummer. You could put, like, someone amazing like John Bonham with Gillian Welch, and it's not going to work.
Yeah.
He's a great drummer. Why wouldn't it work? Because his style is different. What he's bringing to it is totally not right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's how I think of it.
Yeah. I mean, and every art's different. It's just so much introspection and like understanding like what makes something work. But, you know, Greta Gerwig said something that I really liked that was like, our birthright is storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like we're born knowing how to tell a story in some way. When we're reciting an anecdote to a friend or a colleague or something like that, that's storytelling.
Yeah.
And it's just about taking advantage of what you are already given and understanding your niche.
But then there's the skill of being able to put it out there in a way where it's still raw and vulnerable.
Yeah. Well, that's how Lady Bird happens.
Right.
So it's, yeah. But I do quite like filmmaking. So it's very fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all kind of part into Chasing Amy, though. I didn't know that was a job before I saw that movie.
So you're looking to change lives and help people.
I don't know about that. I'm mostly...
Fuck them.
No, I mean, like, I don't... It's so individual at this point where I'm just like, it's a collaborative medium, but I just want to tell stories that I really like, and hopefully other people will latch onto that too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think by virtue of me being a queer filmmaker, if I attain some level of success, right?
Yep.
As a queer and gender nonconforming person or female or whatever, you know, if I attain some level of success, then by virtue of that, I, you know, change somebody's life maybe.
Yeah. And you also, for better or for worse, become kind of a spokesperson for a whole group of people.
No pressure.
Yeah. Whether that's right or wrong, it's just the way it is.
Yeah. And so, I mean, but I think that how you get to that point is to tell stuff that's really authentic and specific to you. So, you know, the stuff that I sent you today,
yeah,
that's the kind of specific stuff I want to do as a narrative filmmaker. You know, I sent you a short film I did called Queen for a Day that'll hit the festival circuit next year. And then in 2019, and then I sent you a script called Pancake Skank.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both those things are like, you know, those show like kind of queer joy that I want to promote in my work, where, you know, hashtag no sad gay movies,
right?
Kind of comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You want to show the more positive, joyful side, which I'm sure there's so much of.
Yeah. I mean, God, we're people.
It's not just about struggle.
Yeah. People are so much more than the worst things that have ever happened to them.
Right.
And we have this fascination, I think, as a culture, to examine what are the worst things that have ever happened to people.
Well, we're attracted to the most sensationalized things.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting trying to navigate that as a filmmaker, because it's like, yes, you know, what is celebrated is often a dramatic story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's totally fine. But I think you can tell dramatic stories featuring queer people where not everything horrible happening to queer people is the center of it.
Right.
You know?
Because there's a lot of joy, too.
Yeah. There's a lot of triumph, and our community is strong, and the queer and trans people I know are some of the best people I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a bummer to, you know, watch movies that only seem to show, like, the parts of it that suck.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, it's really suck when straight people are shitty to us, but also, did you know about this? Did you know about this?
Yeah.
There's a lot of good in the world.
Yeah, and if you can capture that feeling of freedom that you must have felt when you came out.
Totally. You know,
sounds exhilarating.
It is. And it's exhilarating to be around people that are into my weird ideas,
mm-hmm.
you know, that are like, this is amazing and weird, and I have to help you make this happen, even if I'm not part of this community.
Right.
You know, like allyship in that way, where they're like, yeah, we'll do this like no budget movie
right.
with you. Like, mm-hmm. that's fun.
Yeah. Cause any group of people that has been, you know, degraded against can relate, no matter what group of people you are.
Totally. It's just really cool. It's a really cool time in filmmaking,
mm-hmm.
because there's such an emphasis on uplifting marginalized voices,
right?
Of all these different intersections. And I'm just like, cool. There's a pipeline being created.
Yeah.
That is amazing. You know, how, when I started a couple of years ago, that didn't exist.
Yeah.
Those initiatives just didn't exist. And so the fact that there's this emphasis on, okay, let's find, you know, queer people, Black people, Latinx people, all of these different kinds of folks who have been like historically underserved. Let's see if these people have stories to tell, and let's help them make their visions become a reality. I mean, that's rad.
Mm-hmm.
That's just so rad.
Yeah.
So.
Telling stories that haven't been told.
Yeah.
Incredibly often.
Yeah. I mean, it's just an exciting time to be doing this, I think.
So as a programmer for Slam Dance, you program the shorts?
Yeah, so I'm one of many, many narrative shorts filmmakers,
mm-hmm.
or programmers, but they curate all of their programmers from their previous filmmakers. So you have to be an alum to program.
Okay. What do you look for? Or what do they look for?
Well, as a programmer, I look for stuff that is innovative. You know, innovation is like such a buzzword that it almost doesn't mean anything now. But I love
it when you see it.
Yeah, I love stories that, you know, I've never seen before. You know, right. if that's an automatic yes for me. It's if it's something that I know other people aren't doing. Like if I'm genuinely shocked or surprised by your film, I'm like, wow, that's fantastic. A short that I really advocated for, I think in last year's Slam Dance, was this short film called Audition. And I don't remember what country it was from, but it was a foreign language short that was just about this woman going to an audition and she had to bring her baby with her. And it was 20 minutes, and it was one of the most compelling shorts I've seen in a long time. It was just so good.
What was the problem with bringing the baby?
Well, when you know, it's like a mom bringing her kid to work.
Right.
And so, like, the baby would, like, cry when she was, like, reading during the audition, and it was, like, interrupting stuff. But it was, like, she didn't have childcare. Her husband wasn't supporting her. And it was just such an oddly honest and compelling look at, like, the struggle of being like a working mom,
right?
You know, and like having these dreams that you aspire to achieve, but you know, what do you do when there's no place for you in the world, when the world doesn't, you know, care about what you're dealing with?
Right. What do you do if you find something like that and it's so good, but the production value isn't good? Like the lighting is bad.
Story is so much more important to me than anything else. Mm-hmm. But typically, honestly,
yeah,
like I rarely see and I'm happy to be proven wrong on this, but I rarely see a movie where the production values are like abhorrent,
mm-hmm.
where the story is like amazing.
Right.
Usually things go hand in hand. And often you see like movies with good production values that don't have anything to say.
Right.
But, you know, I'll see really innovative stories that are like purposefully shot on like old DV cameras, mm-hmm. you know, where it's like they're using this like analog kind of format to purposefully do something. And those movies don't look great, but they're not supposed to. They're supposed to be reflective of the medium that they're choosing to use.
Right.
And so, you know, production values and story is more important than anything, but I've rarely seen a movie where I was like, this is an amazing story. Right. And like the production values just like didn't add up.
How many shorts do you have to watch to choose?
For Slam Dance, it's my current, this year's batch was 200 films or 50 hours of short films.
Okay. And that's just you or everybody?
Just me.
Just you.
And everybody has that standard.
Right.
So, yeah.
So how many do you choose out of that?
Not many.
Do you get a lot of bad ones?
You know, bad is such a weird word. I mean, like,
because there's something,
a lot of them don't resonate with me, or a lot of them I'm just, you know, they didn't resonate with me this year, but you know, I look at the film and I'm like, I think this filmmaker can make a great film in the future.
Right.
But it's all about like what really stands out. So it's not about whether your film is good or bad. It's, is it right for Slam Dance? Is it right for the audience? Is it right for the other, to go in with the other films that we're programming?
Is there a theme for Slam Dance that they're looking for?
It's kind of like anarchy, punk rock, mm-hmm. innovative kind of stuff. There's a lot of like really dark films. There's stuff that like plays with genre a lot. And there's like kind of dark comedies. It's, if you look at the past lineups, it's really kind of about that.
Right.
And so like there are films that I love. And I'm like, they will never let me program this just because it doesn't fit in with the theme of the festival or the theme that we're programming for that year or what ends up being.
Yeah.
But that's every film festival, you know, every film festival has different audiences that they have to serve. You know, Slam Dance is like a punk rock kind of alternative to Sundance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so while I don't speak for the Slam Dance organization, you know, I can speak to my perspective on that. And
nice disclaimer.
Yeah. I'm not an official rep for Slam Dance. I just get to program there. But you know, that's what I've observed. Every festival's different. Everybody has a different audience that they're trying to accommodate.
Yeah. Are you working on your feature film here in New York?
The Chasing Amy doc?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to do a shoot in a couple weeks.
So it's all going to be filmed in New York?
Not the whole thing. So we'll probably go to LA for a lot of it. And then,
do you have a crew that you work with?
Yeah, crew will vary city to city for this one, but our chief creative team is me and my friend Drew Burbridge, and you know, we've been the two that have been in it from the beginning, and he's a producer, and he was the first person I pitched the movie to, and so, you know, from city to city, we'll go to all the different places, and then you know, if people from the New York shoot, they're like willing to go to LA, even though we don't have much money, you know, yeah. That'd be sick.
You have funding for it already?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Just a tiny bit. We are looking for more.
Good to put that out there.
Yeah.
Are you trying to get someone from Chasing Amy involved?
Yeah. So we've got some really cool interviews lined up. I can't say who yet, but there's some really cool people who are like, yeah, I will totally be interviewed for this.
Because maybe they want to invest because it'll, you know, bring some awareness to Chasing Amy. People can...
Hey, man. I am accepting money for this project and all future projects.
Were you surprised when you were in film school or wherever it was that you learned how much money it takes to make a film?
Yeah, I was just like, wait, $20,000 doesn't buy you everything. You know, when you hear like this was a multi-million dollar movie, you're like, yeah. But then when you realize how quickly $20,000 goes, it's right. Like, oh, shit.
For people that aren't filmmakers, where does the $20,000 disappear to? And that you could blow that in like a 5-minute short, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like the script I sent you, Pancake Skank, that's like a $20,000 short film.
Right. Does the money go?
The money just goes, it goes so quickly. I don't like, you know, you got to pay for lodging, you got to pay for actors, you got to pay for your crew, you got to pay for
crew, light department.
Yeah, rentals. Camp. I mean, just like, you know, a lot of the cinema cameras that, like, a cinema camera that I would like to use on Pancake Skank, that's a $20,000 camera.
Right.
That's a $20,000 camera package. I mean, that's just...
So you rent it, you don't buy it.
Yeah, we don't buy it. I would love to have a camera package in the future like that, but it's just not cost effective for me at this time.
What do you think of the lenses on smartphones? They're getting pretty good.
Yeah, I'm pretty impressed with like the new iPhone, the front facing depth effect that they've got. They're doing some pretty innovative things with like smartphone cameras.
Have you seen any shorts or films filmed just on mobile phones?
Well, Tangerine was one.
Yeah, I didn't think that looked that great, but I think that was mainly the lighting.
Yeah, and I also think it had a specific style that they were going for.
Yeah.
But I've
and that was like iPhone 5. I mean, come on.
Yeah. you know what? Reed Murano and Olivia Wilde collaborated on a music video for Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros. Mm-hmm. And Reed Murano is not only a great director now, but she's a world-class cinematographer. And so she made that look gorgeous, and Olivia Wilde directed the video. But, like, those are... I mean, Reed Murano is one of the best DPs in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like, I think it takes a lot of work to make your iPhone movie look really good.
Right.
And
that would be a lot of lighting.
It's a lot of lighting and, it, you know, just understanding cinematography like really well. I mean, again, Reed Murano, one of the best DPs in the entire world. And she made it look good, but I'm not surprised at that.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people, you know, I think you should go out and like make movies on your phone.
Right.
You know, but like, no, use the tools you have, but know how to use them effectively.
Right. So if you're an aspiring filmmaker right now, you don't need to have $20,000 to rent that camera.
No.
You can just use an iPhone or Samsung or whatever.
Yeah.
And start filming. But the lighting is so important.
Yeah. The lighting is important and like understanding sound. Lenses, understanding, you know, what makes a good movie. If you shoot on your iPhone, try to get some lens diversity in there. If you're shooting the same angle the entire movie, unless you're doing something like that's like one shot, it might be a little boring. Like understand why other movies work really well, and that'll make your movies work better.
When you say lens diversity, do you mean different angles or actually different lenses?
Actually different lenses and angles. Okay. So if you're shooting everything the same way, that's boring, and it doesn't, your cinematography is supposed to help inform your story.
Right. It'll become kind of monotone to the eye?
Yeah, or it'll just look like an amateur did it. You know, so, I mean, if you're going to shoot on an iPhone, there are little lens kits that, you know, the equivalent of like what a 50mm lens will look like on a DSLR.
Yeah.
But you know, understand like when you shoot it from this angle, what does this mean?
Right.
You know, study other people's movies.
You sound like you went to film school.
I did. I did go to film school. It was a good time.
Yeah. So how has it been in New York? I mean, New York is in a pretty intense place.
Yeah.
And you came from Kansas City, Missouri?
Kansas, but yeah.
Kansas City.
I'm from Olathe, Kansas, which is a suburb of Kansas City, Missouri, okay, right. On the Kansas side.
That's very confusing, the Kansas City and Missouri thing.
Yeah, when I explain it to people, I'm just like, just don't question it. Like,
right, okay. Well, it's somewhere in the middle of the country.
Yes.
You're landlocked.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So now you're here on an island.
I am.
The island
I never
of Manhattan.
I never think of it as an island.
It doesn't feel like an island because there's so many people.
Yeah.
But you're not landlocked anymore. You're
yeah.
free. You're around like so much creativity.
Yeah. I had no, I mean, like I knew that when I came to New York, which is where I've always kind of like wanted to end up, since I've been like a cognizant adult. But I never knew just like how much it would like set me free to be in a place where there's so many creative people all doing amazing things.
Yeah.
And just the access that you have here to like different things, like limited release screenings of movies, like, or, you know, people who are decision makers who, you know, want to give you a shot and
right.
help you.
Gatekeepers, major gatekeepers.
Yeah. And like, I'll just like run into them at a party like I did with you.
Yeah.
You know, like you meet somebody at like a book party and then you become friends with that person and then they ask you to be on their podcast. You know, it's like, it's a hell of a time.
It is. And also all the equipment that's available too.
Yeah, I mean, just everybody's doing something amazing. And so you have the opportunity to support them on their journeys, and then they're interested in helping you on yours. And, you know, I just think it's pretty remarkable.
So sounds like you have a really good attitude, because a lot of people come to New York, like the Simpsons episode where they come to New York and Marge is like, all of a sudden I feel like such a nobody. Where you're not making that feeling make you feel shrunken.
No, no.
You're like
at all.
Excited to be a part of it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not from a place where this stuff happens every day.
Right.
Where you just get to do like 10 amazing things a week. You know, it's very much like there is an event coming and you have to prepare for it, or you have to like make your own event or make your own things happen. And, you know, here you have to make your own things happen, but there's so many opportunities to meet new people and to collaborate with different artists and learn from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what a privilege.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good attitude. As a pansexual person,
yeah.
Do you feel more welcome here in New York? This liberal.
Yeah, I don't
hell.
my gay jokes get a lot more laughs here, I think.
Uh-huh. Right, right.
No, I mean,
and no one cares, like in New York.
Yeah, and nobody gives a shit like back home, like who's in my like circle.
Right.
Like, everybody's like, yeah, whatever. And, like, a lot of my friends are queer and trans and, you know, all this stuff. But it's just nice to, like, I went to the Stonewall Inn the other night. I'm like, wow, like, the birthplace of the modern LGBTQ rights happened in this bar. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so cool to be in this new environment surrounded by so many interesting people.
Mm-hmm. You never felt any sort of threat walking around, like say if you were walking with your girlfriend hand in hand back in Kansas?
I feel that wherever I go.
You
I mean
do.
the last time anybody yelled dyke at me was we were on the Avenue of the Americas a couple of years ago
here in New York.
Yeah.
Huh.
A bunch of teenagers. So I mean, like, homophobia is everywhere. You know, New York isn't necessarily an egalitarian, you know, place in that way, or more feminist.
Oh, we got plenty of jerks here too.
Yeah, but it is nice to, you know, to everything's open and there's people don't seem to like identify you necessarily as hard by what makes you different here.
Right.
It's nice.
Yeah. Well, I think it's for two reasons. I think people are just don't care, or they're just overwhelmed and they're just like thinking about themselves anyway.
Right. And all the gays flock to New York, so like nobody gives a shit.
Yeah, you can't really live here and have a problem with that.
Yeah, or, you know, gang of street gays will come and kick your ass or something. That'd be great.
that's
my next movie.
Need.
Gang of street gays.
Yes, bring back like Warriors, but like a gay version.
Exactly. Oh my God. Okay, we have to talk. So Walter Hill, he did this movie called Streets of Fire. Have you ever seen it?
No.
Okay, watch that. People are like, if you ever did a remake, what would that be? And I'd be like, I would remake Streets of Fire and make it extremely gay.
I actually have a script for you. I have a I have a sketch that
yes
I'll send it to you, because it is exactly that.
Yes. Amazing.
Awesome.
That's fantastic.
So when you become, I'm going to be very positive now, when you become a famous filmmaker,
okay,
are you going to be kind of annoyed that the media, at least where the media is now, the media will say famous queer filmmaker Savannah Rogers.
Nah, I like being queer.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you just wish they would say filmmaker?
Sure, in some context, but I'm also happy to... I would be happy to be an example of like a queer filmmaker. But there's so many other amazing queer filmmakers who, you know, don't even get the, would never even get those headlines, you know?
Mm.
So like, if I was ever lucky enough to get that, that'd be really cool. But I just, you know, I want to make happy queer things. You know, I want to make, you know, movies that make people laugh. I want to make documentaries that make you think.
You want to make gay things.
Yeah, exactly. but yeah, and so I embrace my identity. I spent so long like trying to like hide a part of myself that I just can't be bothered with whatever, you know, if it says feminist filmmaker Savannah Rogers, gender nonconforming filmmaker Savannah Rogers, dipshit filmmaker Savannah Rogers. At least they're talking about my movie, right?
That's a good attitude, that, and that it's true.
Yeah.
So when you give the TED Talk, did you say December 5th or 9th?
5th.
5th. Is it open to the public?
No, but it will be online in a couple of months.
Cool. What, it's going to come online after December 5th, I imagine?
Yeah. So they'll take a bit to like edit the TED Talk.
Oh, right.
And then, yeah, and then it'll be online on TED.com. And then if I'm lucky, it gets featured. So,
mm-hmm.
Which means exciting. That you get it in your email blast. You get it in your push notification on your TED app.
Yeah.
It pops up on YouTube as like a suggested video. Like, that'd be rad.
Unfortunately, your feature documentary won't be ready.
No, but we're hoping that the TED Talk can like help.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all right, because I mentioned that this is what I'm doing now, you know, to bring it back full circle. And it's gonna be interesting, the response from that.
Yeah.
I had a colleague that was like, hey, do you have your next film ready? How about the film after that?
Well, no pressure.
Yeah, because they were just like, you know, if something good happens with this talk, you got to be ready. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to polish all my scripts and see what happens.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Great advice. She's incredible.
Yeah. Exciting stuff happening.
I certainly think so.
Yeah, thanks for sharing it with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.